If you want to learn more about the topics of today's episode, visit the podcast website at naturesecretservice.com. Thanks for listening. Okay, people, listen up. Here we go. This is Nature Secret Service, the podcast that puts you in the room with the men and women of wildlife law enforcement. My name is Ed Newcomer. I'm your host. And today we have a very unique episode. I'm sure if you've listened to prior episodes of this podcast, you've heard Meg talk about working with confidential informants. And usually it's been while talking to other agents, and we're usually complaining about how difficult it is to work with confidential informants. But today, our guest is actually a former confidential informant for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and I would like to introduce you to Pete Paxton. Pete, thanks for being on the show. I really appreciate it.
I have to tell you, part of why I am so excited to be here. Okay, so there, Ed, there is this story I have told so many people in my life, and it's this. It's one day I get this phone call, and this guy goes, "Pete Paxton, this is Special Agent Ed Newcomer." And you had a very deep voice back then. I don't know if you remember that. You had the whole Batman thing going on, right? And you go, "The federal government wants you to go undercover." And everyone I tell this story to is like, "Shut up, Pete. That didn't happen." Well, this is the guy, everybody. Okay? This is Ed.
Ed the Fed gave you a call out of the blue, didn't he?
Yes. That's how I'm telling it.
I love it. You know, the sad truth is that the reason my voice was so low when that happened was probably because I had a cold or something. but, you know, that's the perfect lead in because I want to say, you know, the reason that I asked you to be on the podcast, because, you know, you still do undercover work. And so there is some risk to you for being on shows like this. But you agree with me in that you, there's this balance between making sure the public knows what's going on and how things work and that their taxpayer money is being spent for good reasons and all of that. And you have to balance that against, we have to be careful and we have to maintain operational security. But we're going to balance that out. We're going to make sure nobody can see you and that kind of thing. And you're very safe. Yeah. You're very safe in what you do. But let me give you the real story behind that, how I reached out to Pete Paxton. And by the way, that's obviously not his real name. So there was a time when I was working as a special agent. I was doing undercover work myself. I was here in LA, and I'm watching just in the evening one night, I'm watching a television show on HBO called Death on a Factory Farm. And what year did that come out, Pete?
The investigation in that doc was 06, but the doc came out in 2009.
Okay. So that was like right after I had finished Operation High Roller, I'd finished working undercover on Kojima and Operation RTG. I'd kind of been in it. And here I'm watching this documentary about this guy who goes undercover on a factory farm, like a big industrial type farm, to uncover pretty egregious animal cruelty against farm animals. And I mean, we won't go into all the detail of what you saw in that investigation, but I mean, these were people who were just taking, you know, pleasure out of harming and torturing animals beyond, we're not talking about people that are slaughtering animals for food in a humane way. We're talking about people who were just being sadistic toward another sentient being in really disgusting ways. And these were people who, just from watching it, I knew these were dangerous people because they obviously had no empathy toward another living thing. And the whole time I'm watching this show, I'm like, holy shit, this guy, you know, the more that they talked about what you were doing in the show and you were that undercover guy, your ass was hanging out there. I mean, I thought about my perspective and, you know, I had the federal government behind me. I had armed agents who were my cover team. Sometimes I always had somebody who knew where I was and what I was doing. And I carried a gun myself sometimes. You didn't have any of that. You were on this farm and boy, if these guys had figured out who you were, it would have been at a minimum, a serious physical beating, if not worse, you know, yeah. I mean, it's very dangerous stuff. So I watched this whole documentary and I said, I got to get in touch with this guy. I mean, I just said, I have to talk to this undercover guy. So I don't even remember how I figured out how to get a hold of you. I think I just used my investigator skills to go to HBO, I think.
I think, I think you got in touch with HBO and then they sent you to the Humane Farming Association. That's who I did that case for.
Okay.
And then HFA forwarded me this letter and I had to read it a couple times. Like, are you fucking serious? Like, is the federal agent just reached out? Like, hey, let's talk shop about UC work.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And yeah. And you called me and I was so happy to be in touch with you because first of all, my first goal and intention was simply to talk to you about what that experience was like for you. Because, you know, I could appreciate it from my own experience. And then it was like, it was beyond a level beyond what I was doing in terms of like the risk and your skill. I was very impressed with your undercover techniques and your skill and your ability to take it to the next level, which is producing accurate reports, you know, for law enforcement. And then taking it in that case, you even went on to testify in court.
Right.
So, you know, not every undercover agent, they might be great at undercover, but they're terrible report writers or they're not good on the stand, you know, and you had the whole package and I really wanted to make sure we met.
Yeah, I'm glad you did. That really changed a trajectory for me after you reached out.
That's awesome. I'm glad to hear that because the next step in this story, of course, is that as we talked and we stayed in touch over the next year or so, we came up with a plan or I came up with an idea of how you could work for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And yeah. I'm going to ask you to talk about that in just a second, but I'll give a little background of why I came to this idea. And that is... okay, so listeners need to remember the previous comments me and other agents have made about confidential informants. They're not, they're usually unpredictable, difficult to work with, and that kind of thing. So if you find somebody who's really good, you tend to look for a really good project for them. And one of the things that always vexed us on the West Coast in California was we knew that there were fishing vessels operating off the coast of California, up and down from LA all the way up to Monterey Bay, purse seiners, drift netters, different types of fishing vessels that would routinely entangle seals, sea lions, dolphins, other marine mammals, including endangered sea otters, but also would entangle birds like protected pelicans and all kinds of seabirds. And at the time, the brown pelican was still listed as threatened. And then, of course, the sea otter up in Monterey Bay is listed as endangered. But what happens is they entangle these animals in their nets. And then rather than do the right thing and back the nets out and humanely release the animal, try to save it, they're out in the middle of the ocean. They don't care. They just say, screw it. And they run the, either drown the animal in their nets or maybe shoot it or do something awful to it. Or maybe they just run the nets up through the blocks in their retrieval gear. And that breaks the bird's wings and kills them kills them at best. At worst, it breaks their wings and they're maimed and left to float on the ocean. So we knew this was an ongoing problem because dead animals would wash up every time the fishing fleets would operate off the coast.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so we, in my office, we kind of were like, crap, we got to do something about this. And the first thing we thought about was, well, shoot, let's put an undercover on the boats. But the problem is that these boats go out and work days at a time, sometimes, you know, many miles off coast. It's really difficult to have a full-time special agent then go get a job working on a boat. So it's kind of tailor-made for a confidential informant. And the last thing I'll say about this, because people want to hear from you, Pete, they want to hear your story. The last thing I'll say on this is with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, like all federal law enforcement agencies, we're very careful to protect confidential informants. So if we end up deciding to work with one, we give them what's called a confidential number. They have a what's called a CPI number. And that's a contract is signed with them that assigns that number to them. And the only people that really know that number are agents at headquarters, the special agent who's handling the informant, and maybe that special agent's boss. But other special agents in the district, nobody else knows the name associated with that number. So it's a very good way to protect people. But Pete Paxton, when he started to work for me, became known as, you know, CPI. And then there was a number after it. And we pay our informants, and not great, but we do pay our informants for the work that they do. So, Pete, now let's flash forward to your experience here. You get that call from Ed Newcomer. We become, you know, we're becoming friends, and we're exchanging stories and notes. And I ultimately come to you and ask you, hey, what do you think about helping us, you know, infiltrate these fishing fleets? What was it? Do you remember that conversation or what your first reaction was?
So that was a dream come true for me because I have only three, I've done my job since 2001. So it's been 24 years now. That was only one of three times that while I was undercover, law enforcement was aware of what I was doing.
Interesting.
Right? Every other job I've ever done, you know, there's no prosecutor, there's no cop, there's no agent that has any idea what's going on. There's no kind of like support like that. And I thought, not only, and that was the only time that not only was I undercover and, you know, Ellie knows what I'm doing, it was your idea, right? It wasn't me saying, hey, I want to do something. What do you think? And it's like, yeah, well, we'll see if we got the time. It was, no, we got a plan, man. We know what the targets are doing. We know what the violations are. That was a dream come true.
Cool.
And I was also excited to go do it because at that point I had a few years under my belt and the kind of targets that I was working, had begun to, quite literally create, there's groups that if you work for an NGO, like an animal rights NGO, there are anti-animal rights NGOs and they have lists of known investigators to keep us out. I'm proud to say I was the original list. It was just me. it was like back in 2009 when that doc came out, they're like, all right, stop hiring this guy.
Yeah.
You know, like here he is. They had a picture of me from a license. They had my full date of birth. And they had my social up there. They redacted some of it later. They had every known name I'd ever used. And so I thought, man, okay, let me head out to California. No one's going to be looking for me. So right. I was very excited about that. And it was a new experience hitting those docks. And because I'm used to a blue collar mentality.
Okay. Yeah. You've been a worker and to back up, just, I think listeners kind of get the gist, but prior to working with me, you had been almost exclusively doing animal rights investigations, right? Like animal cruelty investigations.
Yeah. My career has been, largely undercover work, a lot of surveillance, but a lot of undercover work, including, you know, working undercover at facilities so that I do animal cruelty cases, but it's all commercial animal cruelty. So like, if your neighbor is kicking their dog, there's not much I can do about that. But if it's a puppy mill,
right.
There's 20, 100, you know, 900 dogs at a time. I can work undercover at that place or do surveillance at that place. So farms, slaughterhouses, puppy mills, and then going to add fishing boats to the list. So I was excited.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And this is interesting too, because certainly whatever these guys are doing on the fishing boats would probably qualify as animal cruelty. But from my perspective in the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, we were looking at it as violations of the Migratory Bird Treaty Act or the Marine Mammal Protection Act or the Endangered Species Act, which the cruelty really doesn't come into play on whether or not they violated those laws. It's whether or not they're killing or trying or attempting to kill these animals that are protected. Yeah. So that was another new angle for you, right? It was.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, completely new laws.
Right.
You know, stuff that I'd never, to be honest, laws I didn't even know existed.
Right. You know? So I think I gave you a little crash course on kind of what the elements were, so you knew what to look for. You mentioned, and I forgot to mention this at the beginning, you mentioned that, you know, one of the things that you've looked at in your career at Puppy Mills, and you are the co-author of a book called Rescue Dogs, which kind of details some of that work in terms of infiltrating Puppy Mills, which, you know, if anybody... It's hard to stomach some of the stories that go on with these cases, but if you want to know kind of the insidious world of Puppy Mills and why you should really only adopt dogs from the pound or, you know, humane societies, definitely pick up the book Rescue Dogs. What's the name you used to author there?
Pete Paxton. Okay. And then I wrote it with an author, Gene Stone, and a ghost author, Nick Bromley. I out Nick as a ghost author every chance I get because he's amazing.
It's a great book, and definitely wanted to make sure people knew about it to learn more about kind of the work you have done. Okay, so what I remember about this is I kind of briefed you in what we wanted to do. You were on board. Yeah. But the next thing I was like is, hey, go get a job on one of these boats. And I didn't know how to do that either. I don't think you did either. It was kind of like,
I had no idea. And so what was new for me on that was this idea that it wasn't just show up and, hey, I'm not drunk right now, will you take me? Right. It was more like, you know, it's like you had to show face.
Yeah.
Right. You had to kind of like hang out. I mean, because some of these guys literally lived on their boats.
Right.
You know, I mean, like they were born in the friggin' water, man. You know, so I had to show face enough that they were that it showed that I was going to be there consistently. It showed that I really wanted it. But it also showed I have nothing else going on.
Got it.
Right.
Got it.
Like I'm not a cop who has something else to go back to. I'm not someone who has some good job. Like I really like, you know, I learned very quickly that what those captains want is they want someone who's going to get the job done, but also someone who cannot say no.
Yeah.
You have no other option.
You're right? hungry. No matter. You're hungry.
Yeah. Yeah. You're hungry, you know, or like, you know, you can handle not having a fix while you're on the boat, but you've got to get that money to get that fix when you're off the boat, you know, a situation like that. So I needed to kind of appear to be that guy.
Interesting.
And then what I learned quickly is that while I've worked with some pretty crazy, I'm going to use the word crazy and unsavory, you know, people, and, you know, there's a specific thing with boat captains.
Interesting.
That they're like normal people. Most of them are pretty normal on the dock. And the moment the boat is out in state waters, they lose their friggin' minds.
Yes.
I mean, they become tyrants and it's like a switch flips, you know? And all of a sudden, you know, man, you are just some scrub that, you know, especially if you're the greenhorn who needs to, you know, you need to do everything that they say, and they're going to give you impossible tasks just to kind of push you, just to screw with you, because you can't walk away. You're on the water.
Right. And you're counting on that paycheck for when they don't get paid till they bring their fish in and then they pay the crew. Right. So you've got to stay on the good side of your captain for the whole time until that fish comes in and is sold, and then you're paid. And then if you want to walk, you can walk, but up until then, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. No. And it's, and then, you know, it's all new stuff to me too, how to stack net, how to throw net out. All of this is new, but you know, I have to learn it right away. Yeah. Right. And then, you know, there'd be stuff, you know, cause I started getting on a few boats and there'd be something that would go wrong clearly in the water, clearly the net went out fine. And then it got tangled up coming in. And guess who's to blame? Me, apparently. You know, they're griping at me for hours until we set the net again. Man, come on. You know.
So they actually trained you, but it was kind of like they trained you under fire on how to do some of these things, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And it doesn't all make sense. And sometimes a captain would be drunk, or, you know, one captain was he was a pill popper, you know, and I remember everyone was nervous when he was gonna, when he wanted to take a late shift at the wheel, because apparently he had almost hit a massive rock somewhere out there in the water one night. So anytime he was taking the wheel, the crew would talk about it and say, one of us has to be up with him. He can't be alone, 'cause he's going to be stoned. Like, I can tell he's already, his eyes are glazing over. He's already there, you know? Yeah. And then there was a boat. There was this one boat that I was on where the situation got pretty bizarre. And, I hadn't documented any federal violations. It was just some state stuff. And, you know, we were holding on, and I'm with the captain and I'm with the crew member, and this crew member kept telling me, he kept making these statements that he would not say them as if they were jokes, but as if he was very sincerely trying to make sexually suggestive remarks to me, until they became sexually aggressive remarks. And he was telling me that, you know, he had all these tattoos, and he said that they were Mexican prison tattoos, and that, you know, he learned to love men in prison, and then he said that there was a guy on the boat who didn't like what he was doing to him at first, but once he made the guy liked it.
Oh boy.
And so I said, hey man, you know, you stay the hell away from me. And then he said to me one day, he goes, hey Pete, we're just baiting hooks, man. We're just standing there baiting hooks. And he goes, hey Pete, when you die, what happens?
Oh no.
And I go, what the hell does that mean, man? And he goes, when you die, what happens? I'm like, I don't know. What are you talking about? And he goes, the worms eat you. Right. And I go, yeah, so? And he goes, well, if you let the worms eat you, why not let me?
Oh, my God.
And I said, hey, man, listen, you stay the hell away from me and only just do your job on this boat. And so we were going to go out the next day. And I remember I had this feeling, you know, I'll never know if it was the right call or not, right? But I had this feeling like something's going to go down. And if it's going to go down, I don't want you we were working under Aaron Dean,
yep.
Right?
Yep. Aaron was the boss. Yep.
Aaron's incredible. Yeah. And I was like, I don't want you or Aaron to think that, you know, I'm creating some kind of a problem. So I thought, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to call Ed and I'm going to tell you, look, I got a situation. I got this, but if something goes down, I want you to know in advance, I'm kind of anticipating it. I'm not going to like make anything happen, but I'm going to deal with it. Mm. Right? Just letting you know. And you're like, okay, I trust you. I got it. And I was asleep, getting ready to get up. Had to get up in like a few hours, get on the boat. And it was like 3 a.m. I get a call from Aaron. She goes, Pete, I can't sleep. I'm pulling you off that boat. Like, oh yep. Man, that was yep. It. That boat was done.
Yep. But, and you know, and that's worth a little bit of an explanation, because part of the reason that this idea came to me was years earlier, we had had a situation where sea otters were getting killed in Monterey Bay. And everybody believed it was the squid fleet, the squid fishery, which is a fleet of boats that specifically focuses on anchovies or squid using purse seining nets. And so I started a little bit of what you did. I got myself on a boat undercover, but the cover was not great and it was temporary. It wasn't where I was working for the boat. It was just like, you know, I was an observer along. And because of that setup as an observer, they weren't going to do anything illegal in front of me, but it did give us a lot of intel about how they operated. And one of the things I discovered about how they operated was, number one, there's a lot of guns on those boats. I saw a lot of guns and there were a lot of sharp edged weapons, knives and stuff. Yeah. But I also saw, like you did, you know, these are not boats that go out for the day to fish and come back. Sometimes they do, but sometimes they go out multiple days at a time, or they specifically go out at night. And to stay awake, a lot of the captains and crew will use controlled substances. Methamphetamine was one thing that I saw available on those boats. And in fact,
yeah, that was so common that they would call them tweaker boats.
Tweaker boats. Exactly. And there was some, I had debriefed with or briefed prior to my work on this with the U.S. Coast Guard. And they had said they'd been looking at the squid fleet for drug trafficking issues, along with some drug trafficking between them and, of all things, the Hell's Angels of California. So we were very aware that, there were some risky people on this boat. And I remember Aaron and I had a long conversation the day before we pulled you off that boat, and we were kind of torn. Do we let him go out on this boat and 10, 20, 30 miles offshore in water that's cold enough that if somebody threw you overboard, you'd be dead before anybody could find you. I think Aaron and I were in agreement. We had to pull you off that boat, even though it was such an amazing inn to have you on a boat. We couldn't have one of our, confidential informants out there with a guy who's threatening to kill them and rape them and, whatever.
I appreciate you looking out for me, man. Thanks for making sure I didn't get raped and murdered out on the ocean, Ed. I never told you thank you.
No, you didn't have to, but it was an eye opener for Aaron and I even to just hear your stories about what was going on those boats while you were out there. I mean, takes incredible bravery to be out there by yourself doing that work. So good for you for, that was the other thing. You were an awesome informant because you briefed me just about every day you went out. You would call me and say, here's what happened today. Here's what I'm seeing, down to very minute detail about here's how these guys are interacting with me. Right. Which was very important for me to monitor your safety and Aaron too. So that's what made you such a great informant. So you just told the story in a nutshell. You did an awesome job. You get into that fishing community. You get ingratiated with these guys. You actually get hired on not one, but a couple boats and kind of jumped around a little bit looking for the most likely violator. And then we finally find that boat and you get threatened and it's a scary situation. So we have to pull you. And that was like, we never got any federal charges, federal wildlife charges off of that time. Right.
Yep.
Nothing.
Years later.
So the next thing is we stay in touch and we're looking for another thing for you to do. Right. But, at 2015 rolls around, I get assigned to go to Africa for 5 years. So I'm kind of out of the picture. So fill us in. You went back, you figured out a way to go back at these boats. How'd that all come about?
Basically what happened was, I was working at that time for a group called Mercy for Animals, and I was the director of international investigations. So they had me going to Mexico and, India and, Brazil. And I was training people and doing a lot of field work and all this, but I was doing nothing domestic and I had some time on my hands. And like so many of my cases, because I'm just a civilian, I work for NGOs, my girlfriend and I have our own NGO. I was just like, I'm just going to pull something together. I just want to do so. Like, I'm here I'm in California. Aaron is right over there, right? Like, I could do something. And so I thought, you know what? Like, that case, that fishing case never came out. And so what I did was I started looking at all the different kinds of fisheries there are. And I honed in on the drift gillnet fishery because I thought it was this perfect combination of things. That fishery had been banned in Washington and Oregon. They'd been trying for years to ban it in California, but the legislation had never gone through. And the bycatch is cute animals. And that's critical because drift gillnets, for anyone who doesn't know, they're mile long nets that have the nickname walls of death,
right?
That go out in the water and they're submerged. And out there in California, they were targeting swordfish, thresher sharks, and mako sharks. And, swordfish, it's not like they're the cutest thing. Thresher sharks, they're kind of cute. They got stubby noses, but they're sharks. Makos? Oh, listen. Okay. I'm an animal activist. I love all animals, Ed. Makos are fucking terrifying. Have you ever seen a Mako?
Yeah, yeah.
It's like they have chainsaws for mouths, man.
Exactly.
It is horrifying. Okay?
Exactly. So, they're like they're like great white sharks in a cheetah's body. They go so freaking fast, and they have a, like you said, a mouthful of razor sharp teeth that's kind of juts out in all different directions.
Yeah, yeah. It's like teeth that face forward. Okay, like it's terrible. And so I was like, okay, no one's gonna go for that. But the bycatch that was associated with them was dolphins and sea lions.
Yep.
And I thought, okay, here's what I'm gonna do. I'm gonna use the experience that I had, and I have a lot of experience. Working on the boats, and I know how to talk to these fishermen, and I started hitting the docks, and I started hitting the docks in 2016. This was like, it took me months. It took me over 4 months of just showing up, and I would tell people, hey man, I'm kind of putting together a video project. Can you let me film you? Listen, I used to be a commercial fisherman, man. Perfect. I know what to film and what not to film. I've worked on that boat. I've worked on that boat. I've worked on that boat.
Perfect.
And then I would show up with a big camera and I would just talk. People would just always see me around. And then I started getting onto non-targets where like the fishery wasn't even happening for those targets, but people would see me go out on the water, hanging off the front of the boat, off the bow, holding the camera up like, oh, he's really doing it.
He's a real deal.
And then, yeah. And then, it took, like I say, it took almost half a year, but then boom, this drift gillnet boat called the Albatro took me out on the water. And I went out on the Albatro and I went out on another boat called the Margaret O. And every single run that we did, dead sea lions and dead dolphins came up.
Wow.
There was not any trip where they made sets where there wasn't multiple dead marine mammals that came up. And, Mercy for Animals at the time, it was not part of their mission statement to deal with that. And you know, their donors weren't paying them for that. It's part of the thing with NGOs, right? It's called mission creep, right? Yep. You're like, I'm going to go do something outside of what I'm supposed to be doing. It's like, well, if people aren't donating money to you for that, you got to honor that. But so they weren't sure if they wanted to do that case. And then that first shot I got of a dead dolphin coming up in the net, the executive director looked at that and said, we're taking this case.
We're doing it. Because these animals are drowning. That's it. They get stuck in these nets and they're air breathers. So they drown. That's a horrible way to go.
Yeah. Yeah. There was even one that was taking their final breath. So oh. Like, man, Ed, there was a dead baby dolphin that came up in one net. It was rough, man. And so what I would do is I would overtly film everything. And then I would covertly film the violations.
Right.
And at one point I even set up some GoPros. And at one point this one dolphin came up and they're like, oh man. And then this is something else. This is something that happens with undercover work. And anyone who's done UC stuff, you know this. If you haven't, this is not going to make a lot of sense, but this constantly happens to me. I start talking to someone and I'm like, hey, I'm in on this. Let's do this. And they're like, all right, new guy. Absolutely. And it's kind of like they want to brag, right? It feeds their ego that like, you're going to see them do their thing. And then the first violation happens. The first time that a dead dolphin comes up in the net, the first time that they're beating a downed cow or whatever the case is. And all of a sudden they remember, oh wait, I don't know you.
Right.
Right. And that's when they sweat you down. And so that's when it was on the Albatro and the Margaret O. It was that first time, man. That's when they start saying, this is what they would say. You a cop?
Right.
No, I'm not a cop. You better not be a cop. Because if you are, you're going in the water. Which to explain that mindset, their thought process was this. I think you're a cop, so I'm going to threaten to kill you. Right. I'm not a cop. I'm not a cop. And they're like, oh, the GoPro. And I'm like, oh, right. I forgot. And so I reach up and I grab the GoPro and they're all freaking out facing the dolphin because they realize, wait, he actually just saw this, even though they knew this was going to happen.
Right.
And I was thinking, like, I know I got this on the UC cam, But man, what a shot that the GoPro's getting coming up in it. So I walk around. The net comes off a giant spool on the boat.
Right.
And I walk around it. I open up the back of the GoPro, pull the memory card out, put a blank one in, throw the memory card in my vest, close it, and then I come around and the captain's son is walking around falling. What are you doing, Pete? What are you doing? I'm like, look, I'm just erasing the footage. I'm just making sure it's erased.
Beautiful.
And so that was it. I was solid after that.
Yeah. Well, then they know you're in on it, right? And you're willing to do it. You know, that's very interesting comment because I've always told like newer agents when I would train new agents who came on, Every undercover case I ever did, from the first one to the last one, I was always quizzed about whether or not I was a cop. And I think sometimes people get so scared and worried, undercover agents get scared and worried that they're burned. Just because somebody asks who you are. Anybody committing a crime, like you said, they're going to be like, ooh, who's around me? Do I know this guy? If not, I better double check and reassure myself that they're not law enforcement. So you're always going to get questioned. If you don't get questioned, you're probably not onto anybody that's doing anything illegal.
That's 100% accurate. It's something that it doesn't, you wouldn't think that's the case until you experience it. You would think that because they're questioning me, I did something suspicious or something.
Exactly.
Happened, right. But yeah, you wouldn't think that, like, wait a minute, you just committed a slew of crimes in front of me. Now you're asking me. In fact, I just had a case. It was a different case just a few years ago, and these two guys were specifically saying to me, they thought I was they had gotten burned by the USDA, and they're like, how could the USDA know? And it was a total coincidence. They're like, well, maybe it's the new guy. Mm-hmm. And not only did they say, are you with the USDA? They said, are you wearing a wire? And I was like, man, what the hell? And they're like, and then one of them goes, because if you are, we're going to kill you.
Right.
So they just asked me if I'm recording the conversation in which they said they would kill me if I'm recording it. So people do stuff that doesn't make sense.
No. And this is, you know, this is one of those situations where, going back to the boat, just to reiterate with listeners, how dangerous that situation is. You know, they threatened you, said, if you're a cop, you're going overboard. But it was dumb of them to say that, because if you are a cop, presumably, you know, you're either going to testify later or something's getting recorded. But, you know, the reality of the situation is, even if you were a cop and they were suspicious of you or they found your recording device or whatever, they caught you switching out that SD card, they beat the crap out of you and they throw you overboard. All they have to say is, yeah, he got hit. The net boom was swinging and he got hit and he fell over and we looked for him. We couldn't find him because literally in the waters off of California, you're going to live, unless you have a Mustang suit on, you're going to live about 20 minutes max. And then you're going to go into hypothermia and you're going to dry and drown. So they could easily dump you overboard, leave you, and there would not be enough evidence to prove that they murdered you. They could just say, hey, he got hit by a boom. We looked for him. He fell overboard. It happens all the time. Like, legitimately, it happens. Fishermen die all the time. So it is a very dangerous situation that you were in. So this is very cool. So now you're on these two boats. You're actually documenting violations. You're actually getting their reactions too, which is, you know, which shows knowledge that they know they're breaking the law. Don't put this on your camera kind of stuff. How did that develop then? What happened after that?
So I was giving all of the evidence. I was in touch with Erin.
Okay.
You know, letting her know, you know, I wasn't signed on as a CI, so it wasn't like the old days, you know, but I was in touch and letting her know, hey, this is what I'm doing. And then she got me in touch with the U.S. Attorney's Office and NOAA.
Okay.
Once we went to NOAA, because, you know, it was marine mammal violations and they were going to handle that. Basically it was, you know, they waited for all the evidence to come together. And then, you know, we said, look, you know, our ultimate goal with this is to go to the press and use this to help pass legislation that will ban this fishery from California. Like, okay. You won't be able to own these nets, you know, in state waters.
That was the goal of the NGO you were working for. Yeah.
That was the goal of the NGO. Yeah. And there were a variety of NGOs that had been working on that. And so, but, you know, no one had evidence of this, you know, actual footage of the sea mammals coming up dead, which, by the way, I guess what I should say real quick is that the reason it's a violation, which I didn't know this until I started doing work for you, is that perfectly legal to have a dolphin come up dead in your net. Perfectly legal. It's that you have to report it.
Exactly.
And I feel after all of this time on those boats, hanging out at the docks, talking to all these captains, working undercover on the boats, I feel very comfortable saying virtually no one reports their bycatch.
Right.
You know, yeah, what you see on these fishing shows is someone aware that the camera is there and they're putting on an act.
You bet.
You know, it's, yeah. And so, you know, I was filming the violations, then taking pictures of their fishing records showing they are reporting nothing. And so, the U.S. Attorney's Office got with Noah and Aaron to pull that together to work on finding the captains. But that case came out, the footage came out and was released in 2018, and boom, that legislation passed in California and the fishery is now banned. There are no drift gill nets in California.
Awesome. Cause it, yeah. I mean, that is awesome because it's there. You know, there's people out there that are arguing, we've been in the fishing business for generations and we need to be able to keep fishing like this. No, actually yeah. not. Because if you've been for generations doing massive damage to protected animals, marine mammals, seals, sea lions, dolphins, whales, they're all protected by the Marine Mammal Protection Act. Some of them by the Endangered Species Act. Yeah. We're not, you don't get to continue your family business and wipe out species in the process of doing it. That's just not part of the plan.
Yeah, 100%. There's a conversation that I had with several captains, and it's as strange as the conversation that's like, wait a minute, if you're a cop, I'm going to kill you. It's the conversation would be this. They would say, oh, these stupid regulations, you know, there's no point. And why do we have to have regulations? And they're going to give us quotas. That's just dumb. I mean, I do have to say that a lot of the fish have disappeared because we overfished them. And so I understand why they have the regulations, but there's no point to regulations. I mean, it's like I wish I had all of those conversations on tape, because the mental gymnastics that they would do within 2 minutes of discussing it was just, it made no sense. You know?
Yeah. I've heard it myself before many times, and you know, often they'll blame other fishermen or other, you know, but it's never them. Right.
Right. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's always someone else. It's never them. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. And then they'll go out and then dead dolphins coming up in the net.
Yeah. You know, just so listeners understand, to remind them, when you first described this, you're talking about nets that go out behind just a single boat for miles. And they're potentially, it's not just one dolphin. You know, we're talking about if you aggregate all the boats, you're talking about many, many, probably hundreds of miles of net out there killing who knows how many. And if you're not reporting it, we don't know how many you're killing, right? It might be way more than the population can support.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, I mean, it's like this, you know, it's not a coincidence that it just so happens that the two boats that I was on, that every trip on those boats, I saw dead dolphins and multiple dead dolphins, multiple dead sea lions on every trip. It's not like it's isolated to that.
Right.
Yeah. And I mean, and they would tell me about, so they told me about, you know, a great white shark that got tangled up in the net and was dead. You know, they told me about a whale, you know, a pilot, but they've told me about all that stuff. And I photographed their catch logs. I mean, nothing about
nothing that. Nothing in whatsoever. There. Right. Right. And great white sharks are a state protected species under California law. So that's also a concern. Really cool. So you were able to, this is really neat because you combined the world of what you were doing with the NGO, the animal protection, animal rights, animal cruelty issues, with conservation as well. Right. The conservation law enforcement agency's interests in protecting species as a whole. Right. Did the U.S. attorney charge those captains as a result of your case?
Yeah. So what happened with that was, there was two boats, so the Albatro and the Margaret O, and the Margaret O is still out there. They've changed their fishing gear. And I forget, it was something like an $8,000 fine. It was a small fine, because with them, what I did not do was get one entire steady shot of the entire net going out and coming back to show that they didn't have these devices throughout the net that is supposed to emit the sound of a, it's like a ping. It sounds like a killer whale that keeps the sea mammals away. What I did do was I showed different portions of the net, and then I showed how they had those devices in a bucket on the top of the boat instead of on the net. But because I didn't get that entire steady shot, they're like, I'm sorry, you know, that's a problem. But I got it on the albatross, which resulted, it was like over $70,000, if I'm not mistaken. It was a massive fine, but irrelevant, because the albatross mysteriously sunk in harbor. So, you know, I guess the captain saw the writing on the wall there.
Yeah. Can anybody say insurance fraud, right? Is that an
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, which, so, I mean, and so that's, you know, it's disappointing, you know, that not everybody was, you know, sent to jail. Not everybody was, you know, hit with a massive fine, but, you know, banning an entire fishery, and knowing that will save lives,
right?
You know, and that saving those lives, that's going to be so, you know, such a not just a benefit to those individual lives, but to all the wildlife in the ocean. You know, that's what it was all about.
Yeah. I mean, and that's what's great about this case is you were able to separate out. You've got the criminal law, federal law enforcement stuff you're documenting and reporting. And then you've also got the goals of the NGO, which is to take a hard look at this, drift netting and to expose kind of what's happening and at least inform legislators and the public about it. And great result on both sides. I mean, it is the perfect marriage with different interests coming together to achieve their respective goals without interfering with each other, you know?
Yeah. But it you know, very seriously, you know, it would never have happened without you. You know, if I never would have thought I could go out and I can work undercover on fishing boats and that I would even know what the violations are that would be on them. And that, you know, there's federal agencies that will say, yes, we'd love to take that evidence and do something with it. You know, if you had not reached out all those years before, that was the catalyst to that. You know, there's an enormous amount of NGOs that have laid down the entire foundation to help pass that legislation. So I'll do credit for them. But I have to say, like, I think the footage really helped to get it passed. Right. And the footage would not have existed if you had not written that letter all those years ago, man.
Very cool. I love it. Do you feel like working, you know, connecting with not just me, but the feds in general, and working with law enforcement in the way that you worked with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, did that kind of have an impact on your success or your interest or ability to work with other law enforcement agencies on the animal cruelty stuff in the future?
No. I really want to say yes, man. So basically is that, this is a whole thing. And I discuss this in my book because, you know, obviously I'm someone where, you know, before I did this, I wanted to be a cop. I wanted to go into law enforcement. I was both pursuing a career in law enforcement, you know, studying criminal justice, and I was becoming an animal rights activist. And so I did this job to kind of like, hold on, let me split the difference and maybe this is where I'm needed. But I, you know, I had that much of a mindset for law enforcement. And I have worked with, you know, incredible cops, incredible agents, you know, you and Aaron. That said, I have been illegally arrested and wrongfully convicted for a crime I didn't commit on a dog cruelty case. I have had cops, I just recently filmed a cop committing animal cruelty. He's still a cop. You know, I've had another cop, we got body cam footage from a cop who responded to, this subject that I filmed committing animal cruelty. And he says, you see on the body cam footage, he tells her twice, if he sees me, he's going to kill me. And she laughs.
Jeez.
You know, I've, Yeah, so I've worked with very good law enforcement that has taken the evidence, nailed the bad guys, and did wonderful. But the amount of stories that I have where I am out there in rural America and what I'm doing is a cruelty case that is a threat to a member of the community and a major taxpayer in the community. More often than not, there's this response from local law enforcement that is either not welcoming or threatening. Mm. And it breaks my heart to say that, because I know you have a lot of LE listeners and I love y'all. Mm-hmm. I'm not trying to make anyone feel bad, but that's the truth on my side of things.
No. And you know, I appreciate your honesty on that, because it's important. It's really important for law enforcement to recognize its own issues that it needs to deal with. Right. But it also gives me an opportunity to get up on my soapbox just a little bit, because even in the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, sometimes there is a, you know, there's a reluctance to, I guess, I don't want to say acknowledge, probably isn't the right word, but associate with animal rights groups, because they're often viewed as kind of radical or, you know, kind of pushing the edge of the envelope or whatever. And certainly I've had negative experiences with animal rights groups that are too, you know, they don't understand the law. They don't understand what needs to go into a criminal, proving a criminal case in court, and the steps we need to take to protect people's constitutional rights and all that stuff when we do an investigation. And they can be incredibly annoying because they accuse, you know, a guy like me of not doing my job because I'm not doing it fast enough or in the way that they envision it ought to be done. But there's a middle ground there, right? Like, there are places where the interests overlap. And if, local police need to remember, animal cruelty is a crime in almost every state. And in many states now, it's a felony and can be a felony in certain circumstances. And it's proven over and over again that animal cruelty can lead to crimes against human beings. You know, the people that are predisposed to hurting an animal early in life often go on to hurting human beings. So regardless of what they think about it, there is a public safety issue and there's a legal issue that they need to pay attention to. And my soapbox would be, look for the people that can help you get your job done in whatever form that takes. So when I see, you know, Pete Paxton on death on a factory farm, I'm not thinking, oh, is this a crazy animal rights guy? I'm looking and I'm saying, this dude is an incredible investigator who's got, you know, more courage than I have on these undercover cases. we got to capitalize on this guy's skills and abilities. And in fact, I tried to recruit you to become an agent hard. I thought you should be a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service special agent. We ran into the age problem.
I was really considering it. In fact, if it hadn't been the age thing, that fishing case may not, the Drift Gillnet case may not have happened.
Yeah.
You know, I really thought my career was done, wanted to go back and pursue a career in law enforcement, and was actually at the point of applying, not just, you know, I dealt with the age problem, but then I was applying to state agencies, local agencies, you know, no one was accepting my applications. And I made this last ditch effort to turn my career around. And that happened. It's been nonstop work.
Awesome.
All these years later. I appreciate all, like, every time I've had, you know, when I have evidence and all I need is for LE to take it, like, that's it. And whenever they're skeptical or they're thinking, who's this crazy activist? I guess one thing I can say is, like, just as there is the bad cop stereotype, there's the crazy activist stereotype.
Sure.
And it's real.
Sure.
It's true. I run into them myself. In fact, I just gave a speech at an animal rights conference not too long ago about the difference between being a hero and being a professional.
Right.
You know, because I see it in the movement. I see enough people that, you know, they want to romanticize what I do. And I have to explain, like, I know many other professional undercover investigators in the animal rights movement who agree with this. You know, we are absolutely sure as hell not heroes.
Yeah.
You know, we undercover animal cruelty work means being in the position where the worst things happen. And we don't break the law, but we do a lot of we do the job. Yeah. You know, if you're undercover at the slaughterhouse, what do you think you're going to do?
Yeah.
You know, if you're undercover at the hog farm where people are castrating pigs and, you know, what do you think you're going to do?
Right.
You know, and it's not hero work. Yeah. And so there needs to be an attempt, I think, on both sides, kind of like make sure we portray, you know, not just act correctly, portray things correctly. So that when we approach each other, we have the right reputation with each other.
Yeah. Reasonable expectations. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Pete, we're coming to the end of time, but before we sign off, I do want to give you an opportunity to tell us a little bit about the NGO that you and your girlfriend have formed. Tell us a little bit about that if you want to.
Yeah. So my girlfriend and I run a group called SEED. It's our website is, it stands for Strategies for Ethical and Environmental Development. Our website is ethicalstrategies.org. We have two ends. We do cruelty investigations, and then we work with litigators to sue factory farms that pollute waterways. So that's the Clean Water Act, Resource Conservation Recovery Act. And so she's the brains behind the entire thing, has formed the NGO, got in touch with litigators, and is working on, you know, suing factory farms, doing all that. I'm just handling some cruelty cases, but we had a big case come out recently where I worked undercover. I documented two more, but then worked undercover at 15 livestock auctions across the U.S. And the footage is all up on, you know, it's online for people to see, where I saw some pretty egregious acts of cruelty at every single place. And 80% of livestock producers get their animals to market, that's like to the grocery store, through livestock auctions, right? And we usually think it's a small place selling a small, I mean, JBS and Cargill buy from these places. And I saw teenagers committing cruelty in front of their parents, parents committing cruelty in front of their kids, customers watching it and laughing about it. And it's what I call a culture of cruelty where you have good people. In fact, I put up stories, I used aliases. I put up stories of some of the people I saw committing cruel acts to explain these are just people.
Yeah.
Right. But they're extremely stressed. They're dehydrated. They're under a lot of pressure. And these animals won't move and they have to move.
Yeah.
And the rule of thumb, just real quick to explain this for anyone who's wondering, when you talk about a commercial animal environment, the rule of thumb is the less human interaction with the animals, the more neglect, the more human interaction, the more violence.
Really?
And at those auctions, constant interaction, get them off the trailer, move them to a pen, get them to the auction ring, get them to a pen, get them on a trailer. And man, if one of those animals can't stand or they're too scared, violence.
Yeah.
That's what makes them fear and pain, right? So we got a story in Vox that hit Apple News top stories. We got a whole website up for it. And we're doing stuff like that so that, you know, of course we want the enforcement end on abusers, but we also want to try to bring cultural awareness. That's really the biggest goal.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, I've talked about this on the podcast before too, with regard to animal or wildlife crimes. And it's true, obviously now for cruelty issues as well, or animal care issues, when you put the commercial aspect to it, it turns the animal, it takes them from being a sentient being into being a commodity. And when you turn that off in your brain, it's not a sentient being, it's a commodity and it's about money. The cruelty comes easier, especially for people who are predisposed to it anyway. So the commercialization really can have an insidious effect. If you're talking about living beings being commercialized, it is not good for the animal involved, whether they're wild or domestic.
Mic drop. Yeah, man. I'm just going to steal that from you and say that in all my animal rights speeches now. Yeah, that's it.
You're welcome to do that, because I've stolen many, many things you've said over the years. So let me just say, you know, you and I have built a friendship over the years. We remain friends and we will remain friends and stay in touch. But, you know, I admire the hell out of what you do. And I think you're, you know, consummate professional. I really enjoyed working with you, and be careful out there. Be very safe. But thank you for all the work you're doing. And thank you for all the work you did for Fish and Wildlife Service and the NOAA agents that you worked with in Long Beach. I appreciate it.
Oh man. Thank you. thanks for everything you've done. The world's a better place with you and all the other agents out there.
Well, thanks, Pete. Thank you so much for being on the show. This is a great episode. I'm so happy you came on the season. I think our listeners are going to be just fascinated to get a window into the world of the confidential informant. Thanks so much. Thanks for being with us. And everybody out there, we'll see you next time. Nature's Secret Service is written and produced by me, Ed Newcomer, and is co-produced by the DHTV team here at California State University, Dominguez Hills. Follow us on social media and connect with us online at naturessecretservice.com.